Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Today's Takeaway Podcast is an extended version of what we normally give you on this podcast version of the Takeaway. It's a full version of our radio program plus some extras. We hope you enjoy it. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and let's spin the wheel. Wheel of Fortune, or roulette anyway, is the game states have been playing since the 1930s to use gambling to bring jobs and revenue into their coffers. We will see which states are feeling lucky this week with legalized gambling on the ballot in the East and West. Today, we'll also try to solve the mystery of why President Obama has no coattails, even as the GOP seems to be weaker than it has been in a generation. The Democrats do not play a long game. Have you noticed? They're more into the slots, apparently, in 2014. Todd Zwillick, back in D.C. from his road trip, joins us to think big thoughts and probably set me straight a little bit. And later, the Dallas police chief decides to pull back the curtain and make his department transparent with a new website to improve community relations. And we also this hour have a very important discussion of why the Ebola crisis might just be the biggest development in international cooperation since the end of World War II. But we begin with this. And I love this. Here's Vice President Biden being helpful to the president, making excuses for why President Obama is barely to be seen on the campaign trail in 2014.
I ran for the Senate six times. And one of the things I know about Senate races, off years and on races, and on years, the same with governor's races, is that it's all local. It all gets down to what the specific issues in that district are, that state is. There are lots of places where, and first term, second term, George Bush didn't show up, the older Bush, Reagan. I mean, you know, every state is different.
Biden didn't mention there on CNN that Obama passed the milestone of his 200th round of golf since he took office. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, welcome back to D.C. with us once again. Hey, Todd.
Hi, John.
So no coattails for Obama. Is Biden right? This is the way it is every 4 years, every midterm election. There's no coattails. It seems to me with the 2012 result, the GOP is as weak as it's ever been. What's going on here?
Well, I think the vice president is right and wrong at the same time. He's right that this is nothing new. Second terms are traditionally tepid and or dismal for presidents. It was that way for George W. Bush. It was that way to an extent for Reagan and for Father George Bush. Not so much for Bill Clinton, because the economy was booming even after impeachment. He was doing great with approval ratings above 70%.
And the impeachment was actually a campaign issue for him. He mobilized his base with the impeachment.
And he did. Now, President Obama really falls into the prior category. You're tempted, John, to think, well, it's scandals. It's Benghazi. It's the IRS. It's ISIS. It's Ebola. But the data shows that those types of scandals or perceptions of ineptitude from a White House, they tend to bump and then regress to the mean. But, you know, my analogy is it's hard to look at a bowl of soup and know what all of the ingredients are. You see some carrots in there, so you say, all right, well, the economy's bad. That's definitely true. You might see some pieces of chicken. You know those are in there. But you don't know all the constituent parts. It's complex. Second-term presidents do poorly. The most important ingredient, the economic recovery, is tepid. Now, Joe Biden is wrong about another thing. Not all of these races, especially this year, are local. Just take Kentucky.
Right.
Look how hard Mitch McConnell has tried to nationalize this race to tie Alison Grimes to President Obama. That ain't local.
Same way in Georgia, as you reported last week, same way in Iowa. By the way, Vince, let's make sure that soup metaphor gets put on the Christmas tape for the Takeaway party this year. Todd, before we go, isn't there an issue here that the president just isn't really good at the bully pulpit sort of thing? He can't rise above this stuff with these big crises.
Well, he's never really shown much of an appetite for retail politics. He did great at it in his election and in his re-election. But all of these states where he's not very popular, it just doesn't behoove them to bring the president in. In some places, it's not an easy decision. When you look at Georgia and how hard Michelle Nunn wants to get African-American voters out to the polls, and she's lagging now, by the way, although we're probably still headed for a runoff there, it's a trade-off. Could you bring President Obama in? Sure. Will you offend a lot of moderate white voters who don't like the president? Sure. That's the roulette game. You can bet on red or black, but then you might not get odd even.
Spin the wheel. Todd Zwillick, thanks so much. Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks, Todd. See you next time.
You bet, John. You bet.
Which way is the pendulum swinging regarding legalized gambling in America these days? Tomorrow, voters in 8 states will be asked to consider expanding gaming. It's a mix of Indian-run casino ballot measures on the model of Foxwoods and Mohegan Sun in the east, legalizing limited casino games like video poker, craps, and roulette, and new state lotteries. But in one state, the pendulum may be swinging back the other way. 3 years ago, Massachusetts legalized Las Vegas-style casino gambling to spur jobs and state revenue. So far, 2 casinos and a slots parlor have won licenses. But on Tuesday, voters will decide whether or not they can open at all. Robert Steele is a former U.S. congressman from Connecticut. He wants Massachusetts to be the first state to back away from legalized gambling. He's also the author of The Curse, big-time gambling seduction of a small New England town. The seduction, he says, is old-fashioned campaign bribery.
The theme, of course, is jobs. It's all about jobs. It's not about gambling. It's not about the social costs or the public health costs or the economic downside. It's about jobs.
If it's about jobs, I mean, everyone wants to, you know, be a job creator in this environment. You know, these are service jobs. They're not manufacturing jobs. And how are they different from a Walmart, which candidates tend to support, even though there is some controversy about Walmarts coming in and hurting the downtowns of small villages in New England?
Well, these jobs are quite different. First of all, when I wrote my book and I did the research on the book I did, I interviewed at least 100 different casino employees at all levels. And I would always ask in the end, I'd always ask the question about how they would describe their job. And the common denominator was always basically this: well, my job is to keep you happy while you lose your money. And it's very, very difficult to build an economy on that kind of job. Furthermore, you know, many of our top economists have addressed this issue over and over. Paul Samuelson probably did it best. He's one of our greatest economist, and he talked about casino gambling as the sterile transfer of wealth from one entity to another without creating any new wealth. So this is basically a transfer. It's a transfer from increasingly low-income people, minorities, women, the elderly, low-wage earners, etc., to the casinos. And about 80% now of the casino profits are coming from slot machines, very advanced, a whole new generation of slot machines that are engineered to keep people playing as long as possible, to lose as much money over time as possible. So this has really become, and this enormous explosion of casinos across the country, we now have almost 1,000 of them. This has become a kind of the industrialized fleecing of lower-income people in the United States.
That's Robert Steele, former U.S. congressman from Connecticut. For a look now at gambling in other states across the country, Clyde Barrow joins us. Clyde is chairman of the Political Science Department at the University of Texas Pan American and project manager of the Northeastern Gaming Research Project. Professor, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello.
Where do we fit the pendulum in all of this in terms of legalized gambling? Is it possible that Massachusetts is going to reverse a trend here, or are they an outlier?
Well, it's possible, but in some respects, Massachusetts would definitely be an outlier if it was to approve a referendum of this sort. Since the modern age of gambling began in 1931 in the state of Nevada, no state has overturned expanded gambling legislation on the scale that's being proposed in Massachusetts.
Is there a dilution factor nationally in the sense that You know, there's a cannibalization of audiences, of the Vegas audience, the Atlantic City audience, the Mohegan Sun audience, the Foxwoods audience.
There's certainly some prospect of that, and I think we've probably started to see it in some of the regional markets. Nationally, casino gaming is starting to grow again. The same is true generally in the Northeast, where gambling revenues have increased about $2 billion over the last 3 to 4 years. But you are starting to see instances where an increase in supply is not yielding an increase of revenue, and that would be a basic measure that we've reached the maturity and saturation in some markets.
There's also a class issue here in the sense that Vegas has morphed into a tourist destination. I mean, even beyond purely gaming. I mean, it's a, you know, it's a theme park, almost a Disney-fied destination. But the riverboat gambling along the Mississippi and in Alabama and those areas, those deal with a much different clientele.
There is some difference in the markets. As you pointed out, in Las Vegas, casinos get about 50% of their revenue from non-gaming amenities at this point, hotels and shows and other kinds of entertainment activities they have available. When you start looking at things like racetrack casinos with slot machines or the riverboats, they tend to draw most of their customers from within a 30 to 45 minute drive time. So it's mainly local residents. They're not poor, but they tend to be lower middle to middle class.
What's your view of Proposition 48 in California that's Indian-sponsored but off-reservation gambling, which is a bit of a hybrid of what's gone on in the Northeast?
Yeah, there's no question that off-reservation gaming is a national trend, and the U.S. Department of Interior has been more and more sympathetic to allowing off-reservation gaming, particularly for poor tribes who have their reservations sort of in out-of-the-way places where they don't have much of a gaming market. The problem there, again, is they're starting to run up against other tribes. They're starting to saturate some of the local and regional markets. And it's raised questions about how much gambling some of these local markets can sustain. So it doesn't surprise me that you're starting to see a backlash in the referendum such as California.
And the moral debate, the prohibition debate, the old Puritan debate is kind of out of the question here in the United States?
Pretty much. I mean, it's not completely disappeared. The polls that are done every year suggest that only about 13% of Americans now who believe that gambling is just morally wrong and are opposed to it on moral grounds. Some people have other concerns, you know, social costs, economic costs, things of that nature. But the moral argument has pretty much been lost.
Clyde W. Barrow is chairman of the Political Science Department at the University of Texas Pan American and project manager of the Northeastern Gaming Research Project. Enough of this penny ante stuff. Beyond blackjack and slots, what's the biggest life gamble you've ever made?
Hi, this is Veronica calling from Twin Cities, Minnesota. My greatest gamble was keeping my baby when I was only 18 years old. And now she's 31 and one of my greatest joys in life.
My name is Judith. I'm from New Jersey. I put out an abusive husband when my children were very young. I had no job and no money, but he was acting out, and the risk of harm to my girls was greater than the risk of poverty. 20 years later, I can say it was worth it. I mean, no mistake, it was tough. We were homeless. There were dozens of petty disasters and a lot of hardships, but I would do it again tomorrow.
Some courageous folks there. I'm in the middle of it right now. I quit my day job to follow my dream. I'll let you know. That's not me. That's one of you from East Merrimack, New Hampshire. Call us with your story of the biggest gamble of your life. Be a part of the conversation, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org. And Moo.com, an online print and design company providing software and tools to create business cards, flyers, and triple-thick luxe cards. More at Moo.com.
You know, the movies and cop shows would have us believe that police work is a secretive business with undercover armies of well-armed gang infiltrating street cops, watching everything, collecting tips from snitches, and busting down doors to make arrests. But real-life police departments have not found this glamorous image terribly useful in maintaining community relations. The Ferguson, Missouri police shooting is a case in point. It brought mistrust and myths to the surface about police and citizens who didn't really know each other in the end. The city of Dallas experienced this after grand juries indicted two officers for separate shooting incidents last spring. Their answer, forget the cloak and dagger business and launch a new website detailing all officer-involved shooting data starting from 2003. Full transparency, extensive details about the shootings, race and ethnicity of those involved, weapons used, the state of each investigation, and more. The website launches today, and Dallas Police Chief and 30-year veteran of the force, David Brown, is the man who decided to pull back the curtain.
Well, let me start by saying there's a lot of context and historical perspective when it relates to police-community relationships, particularly in communities of color. And some of the distrust has been earned by our department over the years. But we've done a really good job over the many, many years in making amends, creating trust, working on the relationship where we can really have great dialogue. But I just feel that our relationships are just so fragile and hard-earned and so easy to lose that we can't let our guard down, but we also need to continue a sense of urgency as it relates to community policing and community engagement and not just have it as something we do and not really have a strong focus on. So we've done a lot of work, and I've really worked hard to have our organization, all of our officers, have a sense of urgency as it relates to community engagement.
Have you ever used your weapon?
I have. I was as a sergeant on the department back in the early to late 90s. For about 7 years, I was on the SWAT team. And so I served a lot of drug warrants in this city, in some of the toughest areas of the city. And I've had to use my weapon in that capacity. Someone lost their life, drug dealer lost their life, who was shooting at us. And so, yeah, I've got the perspective from the street cop, but I also have very strong leanings toward community policing because I see the fragility of how hard it is to earn from the 60s and 70s through the 90s with Rodney King and of course, what's happening in Ferguson, Missouri now just continues to pick at this gap of police-community relationships.
Does your presence at a leadership position help that, or do people tend to view you as kind of a, I mean, I'll just say it right out, kind of a sellout?
Right. So you probably don't have so much of the sellout type of narrative. You have much more of we expect a lot from you because you understand, though.
Uh-huh.
And I think I get some benefits from being from the neighborhood, but not much. Because the bottom line is, you know, people have views about police abuse, police misconduct that are, like I mentioned, have been earned by our police department. We've had misconduct, we've had police abuse, and so it reinforces those belief systems. No matter how small or how insignificant or how infrequent it happens, one case of police conduct is one too many, and it furthers the narrative of, you know, all the police are bad. And so we have to work really hard, particularly with young people, to overcome that being the predominant narrative.
Do you have a civilian review board, complaint review board for the Dallas Police Force?
We do, but it does not have subpoena power.
Uh-huh. And will this website be a two-way street, or will it simply be information coming just from your end?
It will be information coming from our end, and it will be a document that won't be static. We think we will add more and more information to this document as we get feedback from the community and others. But the Civilian Review Board will have access to this information as well for any kind of Q&A about any of the officer-involved shootings. It's just the first time we've had that much information over that period of time. It's going to be end up being 12 years available to the public. And so there will be a lot of dialogue because we're including a lot of details, the race of the officer, the race of the suspect, whether the suspect was armed, whether the suspect got indicted, or whether the case went to the grand jury, and what the outcomes were for each and every one of our police-involved shootings. And that's quite a bit of information since we average about 16 of officer-involved shootings a year. That's quite a bit of information and quite a bit of detail to the community for the first time.
What about the training of officers with weapons?
Yes, training in general has been one of the biggest concerns of our profession. You know, are we training around de-escalation? You know, can you shoot the gun out of their hand? Can you use other tools, less lethal tools or non-lethal tools, to resolve conflict rather than just using the firearm? And so we're going to be openly in this document talking about our training and our tools that we use available. We're going to try as much as we can create little video clips for public consumption of the body camera, of the taser, of our training, so that people have a visual understanding and narrative understanding of what our profession can do, what the capacity of our profession is. And in addition to that, we're going to include soon information about our officers being assaulted by suspects. That happens over 200 times a year. Because what's not lost on this dialogue, to me at least, is that we got to continue to encourage our officers to do the right thing. And you can't just beat up on them and keep them encouraged to put their lives on the line. And so I'm walking a tightrope, and I got to be on both sides of the tightrope in balance to make sure that we, you know, officers are doing the right thing and they stay encouraged, and that citizens see transparency and accountability.
Now, Philadelphia's website has data that shows where shootings occurred in relationship with other gun crimes in the area, and you're not necessarily a fan of that whole approach.
Not to be too critical of what Philadelphia is doing, that's one of the departments we looked at when we start thinking about doing the similar report. We didn't want the narrative to be, because, you know, our city has a different narrative maybe than New York. We have a north side of the city, south side of the city, long-held belief that, you know, what people of color live in the south side of the city is more dangerous, and in the north side of the city is not, and the south side of the city doesn't get resources versus the north side of the city get all the city's resources. And so we didn't want to fall into a long-held negative narrative of the south part of our city. And so I'm not a big proponent, for at least for Dallas, of doing a geographical analysis around police-involved shootings and gun crime. I was much more inclined, because it would sound for us in Dallas as if you're making an excuse for high incidence of officer-involved shooting in certain parts of the city. And I don't want to be perceived as making excuses.
And you encourage defendants to use information on this website as, you know, helpful evidence in their cases. I mean, this information is maybe not admissible in court, but you're happy to have people, you know, take a look at this information and use it in the pursuit of justice.
This is the risk of transparency. You show all your pimples and flaws and, you know, bad marks. But this, in my opinion, we're public servants, and this is public information. This is not our data. This is the public's data, and we ought to think of this in those terms.
David Brown, Dallas Police Chief, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate you having me.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry, and in the annals of disgust and outrage, it would be hard to beat the latest statement from the man who claims to be the leader of the Nigerian insurgent group Boko Haram, released a video late last week. Abu Bakr Shakou said 200 or so schoolgirls kidnapped back in April had been married off to Boko Haram fighters. Now, the Nigerian government continues to say that the group responsible for the abduction of the girls has agreed to a ceasefire and that the girls will be released. We asked someone to resolve this matter for us. Alexis Okewo is a freelance journalist who's been in and out of Nigeria reporting on Boko Haram. Alexis, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So how are we to interpret this video? What does this marrying off mean? And why does the Nigerian government, which is experiencing a period of, you know, real credibility right now because of their dealing with the Ebola crisis, why are they insisting on this ceasefire?
Well, unfortunately, this video confirmed a lot of observers' worst fears, because we were hearing from the Nigerian government that negotiations were taking place. We were hearing from the government of Chad that it was going on, but we didn't hear anything from Boko Haram. And a lot of analysts of Boko Haram had never heard of this man who was claiming to represent them. And then two days later, after the truce was announced, there have been multiple kidnappings of women and children and attacks on villages. So basically, when the leader of Boko Haram, Abubakar Shekau, has been talking about the girls married off, it's something he's been saying since the girls were kidnapped in April. When Boko Haram kidnaps girls and young women, it's usually to serve as the sex slaves of its militants. And so I assume that that's what he means when he means marrying off. And it is very likely that these girls are spread out now among a vast area instead of all being held together in one place. And while the Nigerian government may have goodwill in terms of trying to get these girls free, it seems that what they're doing now is just too little too late. It seems that Boko Haram is no longer willing to negotiate for the release of these girls.
And what's the age range of these girls as far as we can tell?
From 14 to about 19, so very young.
And is there a proof of life expectation here in these negotiations where Boko Haram will be asked to either show that some of these girls are still alive or that these marriages have in fact taken place and they will show them paired up with some fighters or something like this? Is that the next step here? Or it seems as though the girls have just vanished.
Right. Well, the Nigerian government is not releasing any details of this alleged truce and what it will do on its behalf, which may include releasing terrorists belonging to Boko Haram and other measures. It's being completely silent, but it's still maintaining that negotiations are still ongoing. So it's double speak we're hearing right now from both sides.
Alexis, would you say that Boko Haram has increased its ability to destabilize Nigeria, or have they simply just characterized the North, where they're powerful, as just that much more of a horror show that really doesn't affect what's going on in Abuja or Lagos?
No, I think they have increased their ability to wreak havoc on the whole country, because now they've attacked Abuja, the country capital, at least three times this year. And they've also staged a bombing in Lagos. So I believe their ability to wreak havoc throughout the country is only increasing, especially as they occupy several towns in the north, including the hometown of the man who announced the truce, who is the chief defensive staff. So as one analyst told me, he believes Boko Haram is winning.
And this could be the beginning of something that could get very, very ugly over the next several months. Alexis Okewo is a freelance journalist who's been in and out of Nigeria reporting on Boko Haram. Alexis, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here is the federal government taking credit for what was widely viewed as an environmental success story back in the 90s.
You can see her inside. She's a big gray female, just gorgeous. It's an unbelievable sight.
The reintroduction of the American gray wolf in the West after years of systematic eradication by ranchers was seen as a return to environmental sanity. But our friends at the Retro Report documentary team, in looking back at this surprisingly controversial program, remind us that one person's environmentalism is another person's dogfight. Eric German, producer with Retro Report, joins me now in the studio. Welcome back, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
So Retro Report decided to look at what really became a cultural conflict between the environmental movement and the Western rancher movement in the United States. What is it about this conflict that I think tells a broader story?
Well, one of the things that Retro Report likes to do is look at a big news story of the past that may have faded from view but still has as unintended consequences that exist today. And this is a great example of that kind of story, because this was an understandably big push by the environmental movement in the mid-90s to reintroduce wolves to Yellowstone National Park. It was something that caused a very big fight, and it's something that some environmentalists have come to believe backfired for them very badly.
When did the environmentalists first begin to feel this pushback?
Just a quick sort of timeline to situate us. The wolves were reintroduced in 96. By about 2002, the population had bounced back to somewhere around twice the initial target numbers. And the pushback began, you might say, then. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service said, well, we've met our goal. Let's take the wolves off the endangered list. and they began that process. The environmentalists immediately sued for several reasons. They sued because they said the wolves weren't breeding across geographical lines in the way that was specified in the plan. And they said that they were concerned that if you turned the control back over to the states, that the states were going to push for numbers kind of right near the red line, and that there wouldn't be a healthy population.
And the ranchers had a strong political sort of constituency within the states. Here's one of them, Joe Mellon.
$60,000 the first couple years. Between the sheep we lost, the calves we lost, every time that those wolves come in here and take a part of my living away, that means I have to make it up somewhere else.
He lives about 30 miles outside of Yellowstone. His name's Jim Moline, and he's talking about in the first couple of years after the wolves were reintroduced, he lost a lot of money from wolves coming in and killing his sheep, chasing his animals, things like that. And these losses weren't widespread, but there were ranchers in particular areas who had really, really large impacts.
And here's Lisa Upson, who really understands that politically this was a tin ear that the environmental movement had here and didn't really anticipate the level of pushback that the ranchers were going to give here.
I think we were all so busy stridently supporting our campaign, and we didn't look at the bigger picture. And so, you know, all of a sudden it was like, wow, this could go very badly. And it did.
What's the definition of go very badly in your view?
Well, what she's talking about is the wolves didn't come off the endangered list until 2011. The lawsuits kept the wolves on the endangered list for years. And during this time, the issue of wolves became kind of politically poisonous. And so it became so political that Congress actually stepped in, did this unprecedented thing where they pulled wolves off of the endangered species list with a little rider written into a budget amendment in 2011. Normally, animals are supposed to come off the endangered list when the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says they're recovered. So you had Congress stepping in and doing something it's never done before. What Lisa Upson is talking about here is their concern that this has opened the door to a future where Congress could step in and start taking any politically inconvenient animal off of the endangered list when they want. And so her assessment as an environmentalist is that, look, we pushed and pushed and pushed. Maybe we pushed too far and we lost something bigger than we were fighting for in the first place.
Biologically, what's the state of wolves in the West right now? And what's the next politically inconvenient animal, perhaps? Maybe that's not what you've been looking at here, but that's a scary prospect.
Well, there are some who say the wolves are fine. There are more than 1,600 currently in the Northern Rockies. But it depends upon which biologist you're speaking to. In terms of the next animal, I think we're just going to have to wait and see.
Eric German is a Retro Report producer. Thanks so much, Eric.
Thank you.
Ebola is killing thousands in West Africa, most tragically healthcare workers. Dr. Godfrey George, a superintendent of a hospital in Sierra Leone helping to lead the frontline teams to fight infectious disease, has become the fifth local doctor to die from Ebola. But in the measured and rational words of Dr. David Nabarro, who has been named the senior United Nations system coordinator for Ebola, the disease is making history, generating international cooperation on a scale perhaps not seen since the end of the Second World War when the United Nations was created. Unlike the 1940s, when international cooperation was all about global leaders controlling their expanding military might, the fight against Ebola has involved all levels of international institutions, military, social, educational, religious, and economic. A surprisingly hopeful conversation now from the man in charge of one of the most terrifying scourges since the 1918 flu pandemic.
I want to stress that in all aspects of public health, those of us in international organizations put the health issues first. Much of our work is involved in providing information and then encouraging people to follow it. I cannot say whether or not there is a particular degree to which communities were sustaining practices and therefore leading to the virus being spread. That will be discovered through historical analysis. But I went absolutely clear to you that the international public health expertise was very clear that there were ways in which death should be handled that would be safe and dignified in the case of Ebola, and this has been promoted relentlessly by international organizations.
Glad to hear it. There's lots of rhetoric in the industrialized world about how the best way to eradicate or to protect people in the industrialized world from Ebola is to redouble and focus intensive efforts on striking the disease at its source, which would mean, of course, West Africa. Do you see action behind that rhetoric?
It's very heartening to me to see that after appeals went out, particularly from the President of the United States and other international leaders, with backing from the European Union, and perhaps most significantly from the chairperson of the African Union, Dr. Dlamini Zuma, we saw a massive upsurge in the resources being pledged for the response. And by massive upsurge, I want to stress this was unprecedented, in my opinion. Within the space of 2 months, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of assistance was pledged, and we've now also got thousands of volunteers, doctors and nurses being promised. I'm glad to say that the number of beds available has doubled in amount about every month since August, and we are seeing also much safer burial practices being adopted and the beginnings of, in some places, of a slow in the spread of the outbreak.
It seems to me that you've succinctly described essentially your job in coordinating this massive and rapidly increasing effort. Is that the case?
I certainly have a role in providing strategic coordination at the request of the United Nations Secretary General. There are many different groups engaged. This is the first time I've seen virtually complete harmonization of the international support with everybody working in synergy, and that's one of the reasons why I'm confident that the outbreak will come under control quickly. I'm particularly pleased with the way in which everybody recognizes that it must be the national governments of the affected countries that are at the heart of the response. They are the sovereign powers, and I'm pleased that in each case they are adopting responses that are in line with international guidance. That makes me confident that we will see the outbreak curves starting to come down within a couple of months, and if all goes according to plan, it's a bit of fingers crossed there, we will see an end to the outbreak in 2015.
Which brings me to my last question. The political controversies here in the United States and in some areas of the industrialized world where many have described a complete overreaction and an outrage and epidemic of fear when there are just a handful of cases of Ebola that have developed for very understandable reasons because people have heroically come in contact with the sick in Liberia as part of the relief effort. Scientifically, isn't it the case, Dr. Nabarro, and I'm not suggesting that we do this, that even if a busload of sick Ebola victims landed in the United States and were sort of allowed to wander around some city, the medical infrastructure in the U.S. would almost immediately be able to deal with this, and you'd never have the situation of a complete breakdown of the medical infrastructure like you've seen in Sierra Leone and Liberia. I'm not suggesting that anything like this would happen or should happen, but we are way more prepared for this than the rhetoric would suggest in the politicians' words. Yes?
So three things on this, and thanks for the setting the scene. Diseases like this will come into the human race from the animal kingdom, often via bats, with increasing frequency. It's just a reality of the way in which our world is evolving. And so every country needs to be prepared for the possibility of outbreaks of hemorrhagic fevers due to viruses, and a health system needs to be able to deal with them and respond to them. I personally do not criticize people for reacting in particular ways based on a fear of what the disease might bring. But I do encourage everybody to read up about the virus, to come to terms with it, to talk about it in their communities, in their churches, in schools, and just to let the fear get into proportion. And that's why you doing this interview with me and the work that you're all doing in radio and in other media is super important for helping everybody to get the issues in balance, and then in due course we will be able to respond in the appropriate way.
Dr. David Nabarro is Senior United Nations System Coordinator for the Ebola Response in West Africa and around the world. Dr. Nabarro, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for the chance.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
A century ago, World War I was tearing the world apart. But at the same time, heavy corsets and oppressive metal and fabric body shapers were holding women's bodies together, in the Western world at least. Today marks 100 years since the patent of the first ever bra. Various breast cupping devices had existed as far back as the Greeks, but it was 1914 that the first mass-producible, lightweight, compared to the tonnage of a corset, was introduced. By the 1960s, bra commercials were little dramas about women's breast problems.
Ellen, I've got the solution.
Not a padded bra.
No, this is slightly padded.
Slightly padded?
Just a 1/16 of an inch lining. Adds shaping, not inches.
The new Playtex Cross Your Heart Slightly Padded Bra. Sometimes a little can do a lot.
That's a young Bernadette Peters starring in a Playtex commercial, A Stepping Stone to Broadway. Joining us now to discuss this century milestone of the bra is Patricia Mears, Deputy Director of the Fashion Museum at the Fashion Institute of Technology right here in New York City. Welcome.
Hello.
So the bra, and I'm not an expert. I mean, the things I'm an expert about regarding bras, we don't need to talk about here. But the bra was an engineering innovation.
Absolutely.
Right? What did it replace?
It replaced the corset, pretty much. The whole concept of separating the upper part of support for a woman's body versus cinching in the waist was something that dominated Western fashion for several centuries. And so what started to happen actually in the 19th century with greater technology and the growth of the amount of clothing people were wearing, the varieties of clothing, led to the separation of the corset, a top part versus the bottom part. And then by the early 20th century, the idea of eliminating the corset altogether gave rise to the need for a bra.
Now, culturally speaking, did women say, hey, you know, leave the lower part of me alone, all right? It's none of your business. Or did men stop paying attention to it? Or
no, quite the opposite. Actually, the golden age of corsetry and really lingerie was end of the 19th into the early 20th century. And it became very interesting because we start to see the women's movement, this push towards liberation and the idea of comfort, and also women who were participating both in sports and in the work environment looking for a greater range of comfort in their underwear, but also the rise of more sensuous and more beautiful, colorful, and decorous forms of lingerie. So you have everything from peignoirs to a variety of corsets coming into play in a woman's wardrobe, almost simultaneously. But what really starts to happen in the early 20th century is that designers and fashion and aesthetics start to change. And we're looking at a leaner, more liberated body. And so the need for less structure is one of the things that help propel the desire towards this lighter weight, separate garment to support the bust.
So you've got loose-fitting garments of one kind or another. You've got bras that satisfy a practical need to, in the workplace, basically keep you from, you know, having all sorts of distracting sort of motion problems, to use euphemisms there. And then that gradually evolves into a kind of a shaping to accentuate certain aspects, cleavage being one of them.
Right,
and that's where we are today. I mean, the Turk Secret is all about that.
Yes, exactly. But all these innovations come out of the late 19th century. That's what's so interesting, the use of metals, when metals were used and when they weren't used. But today is the 100th anniversary of a very particular kind of bra, a very soft cup bra made out of two handkerchiefs and a little bit of ribbon by a young socialite. She had to make it for a party. She didn't want to wear a corset underneath a rather diaphanous dress, so she came up with this homemade invention. Her friends liked it. She made some for them, sold a few, and eventually her husband sold the patent for it on this date 100 years ago. Wow. And so the sort of soft cup bra comes into play much more importantly during the interwar years of the 20s and 30s, but then again gets replaced as the corset and bullet bras come back into play in the 40s and 50s.
What was her name?
Well, it depends on which version. She was either Carice Crosby or Miss Mary Jacobs. So,
but she's the Helen Gurley Brown of basically underwear.
Exactly. Oh. But we wonder whether or not she was part of a larger group of women, both in the United States and Europe, who were coming up with their own homemade inventions.
Now, interestingly enough, the marketing of bras is all about a kind of sensuality.
Absolutely.
But in the 60s, and you heard the Bernadette Peters Playtex lift and separate
thing.
It was all about solving the bra problem that I have. And,
exactly.
You know, it was a really serious problem. What were those problems?
Well, there really weren't any. I think one of the biggest problems is trying to stay au courant with fashion. You have these ideas of highly feminized or historicized styles in the 1950s, again, accentuating the bust, the tiny waist, the rounded hips. Then by the 1960s, women are dressing like little girls. So again, this idea of hiding one's curves becomes an issue. But the Bernadette Peters commercial is right on the cusp of that whole counterculture movement, when the idea not only of burning the bra in its relationship to feminism, but this idea of not wearing hardly any underwear at all, this true liberation in clothing, the changing of the dress codes that's really being propelled by young people. So all of this is going on hand in hand. So one wonders whether this is a ploy on the part of marketing and underwear manufacturers to gain traction, to tell you have a problem.
What other sorts of fashion trends have come along with all of this? It's really an empowerment movement.
It is, but I think it's also a very, very close tie to this idea of following fashion. Again, in the early 20th century, there was a greater belief, even amongst leading designers, Paul Poiret, Coco Chanel, and Madeleine Vionnet, leading couturiers, who around 1907, 1908, 1909 were already starting to eliminate the corset. So from an aesthetic point of view as well as a social point of view, there was a sense of empowerment, even amongst these powerful designers. But that starts to come and go. The 20s and 30s was a fairly liberated period for women's clothing. There was far less structure in what they were wearing, and so softer undergarments, including slips, were very important. But there's a big turnaround again right after the war, this revival, this sort of happy homemaker idea, or this very highly feminized style of clothing, brings back very structured girdles and bras. And so again, you are looking at even women wearing crinolines again. So it comes and goes, and again, with the liberation movements that we start to see in the 70s, a lot of that's eradicated. I think what's interesting is to see the revival and interest in really sexy lingerie today over the past decade or so. Victoria's Secrets and even high-end marketers like Agent Provocateur, which is a very expensive version of that, have been making incredible inroads into fashion.
And you're talking about corsety-like sort of shaping.
Absolutely. And hearkening back again to that golden age, that Belle Époque period, when corsets and lingerie were so important and were part of this sexual vocabulary that we were seeing within women's lives at that time.
Now, when you say golden age, are there going to be lots of people out there going, what is she talking about?
I think
bras today retain this sense of being a necessary evil, and we still have a very strong sense of, you know, throw them in the trash and burn them.
I think it depends, again, on your viewpoint. I think the idea, though, that the bra or lingerie is part of a sense of empowerment for women, instead of covering up the body as we were entering the workforce in greater numbers probably 30, 40 years ago, the idea that you could be a sexual being within the workplace is sort of a position of power in the idea of some people.
So this 100-year-old patent moment has a little of the ambiguity and ambivalence of Columbus Day.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Love it, hate it. And I think it really, again, it depends on the changing mores and people's impressions of this. And a lot of it is generational, too. A lot of older women are kind of appalled by the idea that things like Victoria's Secrets could be such an important element within high fashion, as we're seeing in the eyes of some people, the deterioration of certain women's rights. So it's a very funny sort of tipping point.
Try having three daughters in the 21st century.
You're a braver man than I.
Oh, well, I'm stuck with it now. Patricia Mears, Deputy Director of the Museum at the Fashion Institute of Technology. Thanks so much for a great discussion.
Thank you.
That's all for us. And as we head into Election Day, what should your political party's long-term strategy be leading up to 2016? We want to hear from Republicans on this one and independents. Design a strategy for either party you think would work to cobble together a real mandate. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. And we've got your polling station information right here, so you have no excuse not to vote. Visit us at thetakeaway.org, where we have a poll place finder courtesy of the Voting Info Project. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.